Is your existing supply chain and logistics consultancy provider failing to deliver? Our experienced, thought-leading team at Loguru could be your choice for an intelligent and friendly professional supply chain. If you have a challenge in supply chain, procurement or logistics, or maybe just want to improve the value you get from them, visit loguru.co.uk. Complete end-to-end satisfaction guaranteed.
Coming up in this episode.
My father was a very creative person. He created the first Space Invaders game in 1976 in Cheltenham with his team, and it started off as a military game. He wanted to create something that really tested reflexes and skill. So he created the first version and sold the idea to Tato, and it became a global sensation.
The Logistics Collective podcast is a series focused on the logistics industry, where there are many incredible stories to be told. We'll be speaking with those who've worked and are working within the industry today. What have been their experiences, good and bad, since joining, and would they recommend a career in the industry to others? Here's your host, Malcolm Pope.
Welcome to our next episode of The Logistics Collective. In this podcast, we're doing something a little bit different, and we're talking to somebody a little bit different. Now, if I was to describe this person, I think I want you to get a picture in your mind of the Star Trek Enterprise and probably Scotty, you know? He'd be beaming you up, no problem at all, and he would always make sure your engines were actually ticking over and you weren't having any fights with the Klingons. If he was in James Bond and he was working for MI6, he would definitely be Quartermaster or Q. He'd be abreast of all of the latest technology, and he'd be giving you all the fantastic gadgets to actually work wonders with and get you out of tight spaces, lasering your way through iron bars and all of that. If he was a character, I would say I'm quite fond of some of the old British comedies, and I think it'd be Mr. Chips. Now, why Mr. Chips? Well, he was a nice old character and he really cared about the people around him. But you see, this Mr. Chips, he's got a little bit of enthusiasm for semiconductors, so it's appropriate as far as that is concerned. Now, I've burbled on a little bit, maybe a little bit too much, but you see, I like logistics and I love supply chain, and we often talk about supply chain visibility. When I come to this, I think about, well, if we gave supply chain visibility, if we took it down to our local optician or optometrist, and we said, how good is that vision? You know, would it get a 20/20 score, or would it, in fact, as I feel it is, be only partially sighted? And this chap is all about really seeing how we can improve, get a 20/20 supply chain or supply network visibility. So without further ado, and without me droning on much further, I want to welcome Mark Telford. Hello, Mark. How are you doing?
Hello, Malcolm. What an introduction. Wow. That's pretty unique. I'm very well, and it's a pleasure to be able to come and talk with you today and hear what you've got to say as well.
Well, come on, Mark. Let's have the potted history of your life in retail. And you were Mr. Stripey once with your barcodes and before you went to Mr. Chips. So come on, let's have a potted history of all about Mark.
Well, grew up, I was born in Germany, actually. My father was in the forces and then came back to the UK at a very young age, sadly, before I learned the language. And I was surrounded by, you know, love, and innovation was probably such a big thing. My father was a very creative person with my mother's fantastically creative. I guess I was born in 65. And, you know, for those 35 years to the millennium, there was incredible innovation. And it seemed like a lot of that was centered around my father and his businesses and his activities. He was very driven to inspire and help others. So on the face of it, looked like a very capitalist type of person. His generosity to neighbors and people is the legacy that he left. So much so that when I was getting nervous in 1972 for my favorite football team, the Leeds United, who were playing Arsenal, And he could see that I was, you know, pacing around. And I don't know if you remember those old days of the FA Cup final. You kind of watched the TV and saw what the players had for breakfast and where they walked their dogs. And it was quite a build-up. And my father just came to me and said, Leeds will win today. He said, don't worry about anything. And I said, Dad, but, you know, Arsenal are really good. And we do so well, but we never quite managed to, you know, win. And he said, look, son, the only time I'm wrong is when I thought I was wrong, but I was right. And literally, it took me a couple of years to work out what that meant. And anyway, Leeds went on to win. So, you know, his reputation was intact. And the funny thing is, when we got to the FA Cup final the following year, I didn't ask him the question, and and Leeds lost. So anyway, the die was set. He created the first Space Invaders game in 1976 in Cheltenham with his team. And it started off as a military game. And the reason that he created, so you've got to look at the motivation of the man. The reason he created this was he was really concerned about his sons and our friends all becoming addicted to gambling. You know, fruit machines were in every corner of every pub. And so he wanted to create something that, you know, really tested reflexes and skill, and one where you weren't being enticed by winning something, but you just tried to be the best of what you could. And so he created the first version and sold the idea to Tato, and it became a global sensation. To look back now, only now really, and realize that I had the first game in my bedroom in 1977.
Have you still got it?
No, sadly not.
What?
I think Dad took it out. Dad took it out and put it into a pub somewhere. You know, to think like that, but that was normal in the life that I was leading. You know, a very close, you know, working class family, but all of this innovation coming out. So I suppose you can't help but get influenced by those type of things. And although I enjoyed school, I loved history, geography, English, I loved all the arts in particular, sport was something that really appealed to me. And I not very talented at many things. Football was, I loved it and found it relatively, it was interesting. And so he had set me off on a path towards being part of a team. My friends seem to remember so much about those sporting games that we have. And some, I don't know, my memory, I seem to forget all the good things. I remember when, you know, we just missed out or I just didn't quite score a goal or whatever. Those are the things. And I think that's probably what drives me. And it's good to have friends because they remind me of the things where all our practice did come off. But my life was definitely shaped around this closeness of being part of something much bigger. And so it was only natural that I was going to join the Air Force. I got a place in the Air Force and I wanted to travel the world and teach sport.
You've currently got the moustache for it, to be fair.
Yeah. Brigadier or whatever. Yeah, anyway, you're squadron leader. I remember I was looking to leave after A-levels in about 82, 83. And my headmaster came to me and said, look, Mark, you know, jobs are scarce. You're the only person in the school that hasn't gone for an interview anyway. I said, look, headmaster, I've been offered a place in the Air Force. You know, that's kind of my interview. He said, yeah, I know, but on the records, you need to have an interview somewhere. And I said, okay, but please don't send me to a bank. I'd seen, my eldest brother lose all his hair in the 6 years that he joined a bank. And that was quite important to me at that age. So he said, well, actually, Waitrose and John Lewis are coming to Cirencester, where I grew up. Why didn't you go along there? And I said, look, sir, the day of that, I'm playing football in the afternoon. Is it okay if I just go for the morning? And will they let me leave in the afternoon? And they said, well, probably if you have that attitude, they'll probably let you leave before the afternoon. And of course, they were a great company. I loved everything about the partnership. And I missed the game of football in the afternoon. I made that decision that I wanted to be with people like that because they told me the values of the business, you know, that we would all be partners and we all owned and had a say in the running of the company. And I was really lucky to, join the partnership, but to be around such inspiring people. I met, met the chairman, but everyone that I came across, they all had something to offer. So suddenly retail was my passion. The sport I'd kind of dropped, although I carried on skiing and playing cricket for the partnership, traveled a lot with them down into France and played some great things and great teamwork and camaraderie. That's kind of where I'm happiest, where we're together.
So what I sort of sense within him, which is you've given us a lovely compressed view of how you've grown up, the respect that you have for your father, how innovative it was, how your education, your passion for sport. We've ended up something called the John Lewis Partnership and Waitrose. And we have a lot of listeners that aren't from the UK that might not understand what is unique about John Lewis and Waitrose. And to be fair, they are, I don't wish to give them any disrespect, but they're a British institution, I would probably say. They're a retailer to the middle classes and beyond, more than anything else. But they do offer really, good value. But the key thing is about the partnership. Tell us what you mean about the partnership.
So the unique thing about John Lewis, from John Speedon Lewis, who founded the organisation, it's a partnership. So there's not a bunch of shareholders. Everyone that joins the business has a stake in the business itself. And because of that, I think everyone feels that they have a voice. If it's your bicycle at home, you take care of it. It's your company at work. You are very fiercely loyal towards the brand. So I never kind of really experienced much frustration or gossip about the business in those first 5 years. It was a very, I'm not being idealistic. I lived it for 5 or 6 years. People really, if something wasn't right, that they felt they had a voice and they could go to staff and training personnel or the registrar. And so we used the word. So we were called rank and file partners if you weren't when you joined. And when I've used that term later on in my career, people think, oh, that's awful. And yet, we were proud to have the word partner in there. It didn't make us, before we were management, it didn't make us feel any lesser. So the committees that steered the business was made up of the MD, but also someone who was pushing trolleys in a store. And everyone had value. I still am fiercely loyal about that structure. And never actually felt, once I was in it, that I ever wanted to leave. And that's the biggest compliment that I could give to the partnership, that I felt all of my ambitions as a young manager, they were matching all of that. And it's a terrific business.
So we then moved to GFI and Go For It. So doubtless, you would have had some form of induction to begin to get you to feel around the edges to understand what is going on here. And you developed a passion as far as retail. But in terms of the early days of Mark going for it, which does sound like a 1980s teenagers program, Mark goes for it. What did you go for?
Well, I think my plan here was to learn from the people who have, trodden in my path that I was about to experience. And but then I could also see that there were ways of doing things that were definitely stuck in a previous generation. If you think about it, as I was, finishing my A-levels, computers were just coming into the classroom. I'd been exposed to that and seeing Space Invaders and all this great stuff around it. So I felt that there was a responsibility as well of someone who was quite young then and inexperienced to just challenge that, but also be really respectful that the people probably thought, I didn't have the experience. Luckily, my mentors, the staff and training managers, and the area managers, the branch managers, you know, could see that I was actually willing to try and also take responsibility when it didn't go well. So I learned very early, because I had to work out how did this all run, because up until then I just thought, oh yeah, high street exists and it must be pretty boring occupation working in a supermarket. And now I'm seeing all the inner workings of it. It dawned on me very early on that the rock stars, if you like, apart from the partners themselves, of course, were supply chain logistics, because we were in an era where suddenly, you know, Waitrose would go from, I don't know, 20 stores to 150. And to be able to do that, you needed to have a supply chain network to do that. So it was very clear to me when I would see the distribution director come into a store and talk to me, or at a, we had lots of sessions with the managers, that these people were, I don't, it doesn't sound wrong to say running the show, but they had this gift of being able to scale. That's really the word I would use. So whilst you had some brilliant core values, you know, I was, you know, very much involved in that when a customer would come into a store and they were looking for something, you know, I'd take them to the area, not just point like our competitors did. And I was very much part of that mantra in John Lewis about caring for people. So I could see that the supply chain people had real energy and passion, and I felt that I could do a similar thing within the store. Now, so my time of, you know, captaining the sports teams and being part of some incredible teams at school and in other areas was a talent that I'd definitely been learnt, that I could then bring to 200 staff in a store. So I felt, things like words that are really important for me is trust, momentum with anything that we do, because sometimes when you're searching to improve something, you might have got the right idea, but your implementation is really bad. So I would always talk with people about, like, well, have we got any momentum with this idea? And even if we could find a trace of it, that was enough for us all to keep that going. So literally Waitrose and John Lewis then just pushed me around different stores. You know, I had no commitments. You know, I didn't have a house or anything. I was renting. So for in next years, I was in, where was I? Bristol, Birmingham, Bracknell, Reading, Andover, all sorts of places, trying to make a difference and bring in the same innovation. And I remember one night I convinced the whole team to stay through the night, and bear in mind we'd all had a full day, to try something new with, you know, changing the fixtures around. So we'd put the pre-packed in where the loose vegetables used to be, and we were trying it all. And once you start to do that, you end up, you know, again, momentum, you end up starting to do things that you shouldn't do. And literally, of course, I got a visit from the operations director. He must have had a meter on the electricity bill, could see that we were all still working. And he came in and looked, and with his 30-odd years experience, even the fact that he probably agreed with about 10% of what we'd done, and we quickly had to restore the other 90% without any sleep, by the way, that was enough for us to go on our own path, you know, one that, you know, 10% of the ideas. And I think, to be honest, all of those things about if you feel safe and you're trusted, you can experiment. And, you know, certainly one thing that when I eventually sort of retire from what I do, I'm kind of like, I would love to be involved with being able to help people to have that same feeling. Because, you know, if they don't pay me to do this, then there's clearly no, there's only one agenda from me, and that is to share some of the, you know, the luck I use that I've had in my career. So, yeah, that's a summary on that sort of go for it nickname that was given to me, which I didn't understand, of course, because you're oblivious to it, your own failings or skills.
So again, that is a real good potted history in terms of, I guess, learning the basics of retail.
Yes.
Yeah, and doing that and well, looking at merchandising, looking at interaction with the consumer, with the customer, yeah, which I think by itself is interesting.
Malcolm, nothing was better with your store heaving, for me personally, than talking to customers, helping them. You know, that's and you know, of course, my career after that is all about that. It's, you know, I don't think we had the phrase customer experience, but you know, if you love people and you love that interaction and that dialogue, and then it was a brilliant stage. I was never sort of lucky enough to get up on a stage and act, but this was a kind of a real theatre, and great fun, really great fun.
So it wasn't Grace Brothers.
Yeah, we've all done very well.
Oh dear. Favourite character in Are You Being Served?
Well, of course, I couldn't wait to see his young Mr. Grace come down. I you know, because that was the moment when everyone's sat back. I think, well, probably I was, the chap? He's probably a bit more like my character. I can't remember his name.
Mr. Lucas.
Mr. Lucas, yes. Because he, you know, he's a conduit for everything. You know, he had the banter with the ladies, but he was kind of that, I don't want to say a fool, but someone that could be out there. And you watched his boss and Captain Peacock watching over him, trying to nurture him. So I'd probably relate to that. But then before I know it, I've become young Mr. Grace. You could pick any of them, couldn't you? You really could. It's an interesting question.
It's really the pantomime of retail. But
yes.
Okay, let's move on to, because I think we can all identify. I mean, I've had a, I know it's fundamentally wrong, but you do give certain people nicknames through your career, and I certainly had one, young Mr. Grace.
Well, do you know what? At Waitrose and John Lewis, we would have a notification of the chairman coming to the store, and he probably had the same feeling that everywhere that he visited always smelt of fresh paint. I think the Queen said that, didn't she? And, you know, I was one of these up-and-coming managers, and the store in Bristol decided that I would be the person to greet the chairman, Mr. Lewis, at his car outside the store. Actually, the store was opposite the pub in Bristol where the young ones used to film, which is interesting. But so I went out, and they gave me an umbrella, and at like 18 or whatever, how old are I'd never kind of, I don't think I'd ever used an umbrella. It's kind of not a thing you do. So they've given me this really posh umbrella, and I'd taken it out of the wrap, and I had to test it. And it's torrential rain outside of the store. And as I went to go out of the store, because they said, look, you know, he's before mobile phones, but they must have had some way of knowing that he wasn't far away. Yeah, you need to go out there now. So as I've gone out of the front door, I've opened the umbrella to stand under it, and a tap on my shoulder from the area director. He said, no, Mark, the umbrella's for Mr. Lewis, not for you. And I'm like, and I looked up, And literally, I thought it was a joke, but they were serious. So I had to stand out, and then Bristol traffic in the rain. You know, I felt like an hour. But he must have looked at me as I was totally drenched. But he said, you know, there we are, that young Mr. Grace moment. And yeah, it's quite funny when you look back.
Oh, you see, I think in reality that was a setup. I really do, because, I mean, the setup used to be, if you're a chemist, which I was, would be to go into lab stores and ask for a set of atomic weights, which was always hugely amusing. And somebody would always fall for it, which is utterly cruel, but,
yeah.
But there you go. So, you know, you...
I think it's dawned on me after all these years now, yeah.
Yeah. So, John Lewis, retail, store... all of that. When did the first sparks of innovation begin to come out? Beyond moving everything around in the store, like, I don't know, Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen redoing a house very quickly, and, you know, fine. Getting 10%, getting something right, I think is, well, to be fair, in terms of innovation, it's not a bad result. One in 10 is not a bad result.
Yeah, it's interesting. It felt awful at the time. But then, you know, when you settle down and think about it, and you see that 10% start to build, and then, you know, other great ideas coming off it from other people, it's just that spirit. I suppose by this time, I'd, you know, been around opening new stores and after about 4 years or so. And again, I look back at this and I think it's quite amazing. But John Lewis were recruiting because the first PCs were now, you know, the IBM PS1 was becoming available. And obviously the partnership thought, right, we need to be ahead of the game here. So they brought in three people from the stores who they thought could help implement and train like a stock inventory the first computerized solution. And this was great because it was a combination. This was a partnership working at its best. Because in some ways, you had John Lewis on the department stores on one side, and they're the biggest department store chain at the time. And then Waitrose, and we had, I don't know, 150 stores. So we weren't anything like the market leader, but our customers loved us. So I went for an interview to be part of this implementation team. But lots of people in my ear were saying, Mark, you do realize these roles are only for people who have been in the partnership for 20-odd years, and they're going to get a sabbatical to work with head office. Sometimes it leads to maybe a position in head's office, but typically it's kind of a bit of a break before they come back and open a new store or something. So, you know, everyone that was going for these interviews were all in their 30s, 40s, 50s. And for some reason, the partnership gave me an opportunity at 21, 22 to go for this interview. I was aware of this. And so, again, I thought I had nothing to lose. And then, so that's down to David Smith, Jan Rothwell, who were in the systems team, who saw something in me that would be a good balance to the other two characters who were really strong, who got the job. Yeah, I just think if I look back, they took a huge risk in having me because I wasn't, polished in any way as a, you know, someone who'd settled down or anything. But the combination of the three of us, I can remember Jan actually laughing sometimes, you know, nicely, that this was going to be fun. And David Smith as well, and also David Felwick, who became managing director and head of the British Retail Consortium. So I think there was people, I think you just have to have friends in life and people that believe in you. But it was a surprise when I got that role, and suddenly I had to sell the sports car because I was now delivering IBM PS1s in the back, and the soft top on the Triumph Spitfire wouldn't work too good. Now, this exposed me to the team in Clipston Street, Lee Nash, Pamela Green, Sheila Fish. You know, the names just trip off because these were massively influential in my career. And they were creating software. And of course, with my passion for getting it right, to helping customers, there wasn't anything that I wouldn't do to help them make their software work on these new PCs. And bear in mind, when we were installing these systems into the stores, some people had never touched a computer before. You know, that first keyboard touch was like one small step for mankind, when, you know, all that sort of stuff. It was quite incredible. And suddenly, we started to make our availability and our assortment, our inventory much better. So we could start to plot when there were events like Henley Regatta for the stores in that area, or Wimbledon, the South London stores. And, you know, together, Ian, Eileen and myself created something that was really, really good. So from then on, you know, the systems that went into that was quite incredible. For me, it was the realization that actually we could change things in a way that was friendly to the users actually was going to be the end of my career at John Lewis, because now that I was doing this every day and I could see the relation between implementing a system, tinkering, getting it right, and then getting the benefits, I wanted to do this every day. So literally, there was a quite seismic moment in my career. The national press had run an article that said that found out that one of our competitors, Safeway, had got their price lookup file wrong. So when, you know, you were now, they were scanning the barcode, it wasn't the price that you thought you were paying. So the chairman, again, it's the second time that I met him, turned up at Waitrose head office, and we were all ushered down to the dining room. It was called, not a canteen, dining room. And he My understanding is this is the first time he ever went and addressed partners without a script, without it being approved by registry and everything else. And he announced in front of a full canteen or dining room that the devil is the barcode will never have a place in the partnership. At which point, there were about 100 faces turning towards me because that was what I did, yeah? So I kind of then went and saw my boss, and he said, well, you have to speak to, and I think I spoke to someone quite senior. And it was like, well, Mark, I think you're ready to do have your own business.
So I think on that cliffhanger, after a wonderful career within the John Lewis Partnership as being, you know, the most senior umbrella wrangler within there, and then being told that your chairman didn't like stripy things on boxes, that was time to move on. So on that mild bombshell, I think we'll close this episode. And so thank you ever so much for everybody that's listening to us. Our podcasts are available on all the normal platforms such as Spotify, Apple, Google, and a lot of others. Please like and follow us on these platforms, and also feel free to interact with us on logisticscollective.com. You can ask us questions and send us messages as far as that is concerned. So that's this episode, and we've been maybe focused on past. For the next episode, I think we're getting closer to the present time. And for our final episode, well, watch out for that one, because we're heading for the future.
You can get in contact by email, podcast@logisticscollective.com, or leave a voice message on our website, logisticscollective.com. The podcast is a production by LeGuru.